This is from the Midwest City Free Methodist Church.
But let's have a look here at a certain kind of hypocrisy that goes along with a certain kind of idolatry. Are those two bad things you want to talk about in church? Idolatry and hypocrisy. You got it. I'm against them. Well, Matthew chapter 23. A few words about them. So the words of Jesus here in Matthew 23, I sort of jump a little bit. I'll read, there are a few verses, and then it jumps ahead to a few more verses. But here they are. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. So do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do, for they preach, but do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long." Don't ever do that. I'll get to that in a minute. "And they love the place of honor at the feasts and the best seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by others." Now here he gets down to some woes. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but the inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, so the outside may also be cleaned. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Therefore, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town." And we'll end it right there. This is the inspired word. And those are the ones in red. These words really matter. But what are these warnings and woes? I hope they're not about me. Sound pretty bad. What are these warnings and woes? Well, people know, almost everybody can name the quote-unquote bad guys in the Gospels. I mean, we know, everybody knows who the main antagonists are in the public life of Jesus. I mean, everybody knows that, right? Who the bad guy, who the guys, who he's always confronting, you know, and are confronting him. It's, who is it? It's the religious leaders. That's who he's always locking horns with. It's the religious leaders, called by various names belonging to different sort of notorious groups, iconic almost for their badness. They're the bad guys. But as we've said before, the one group that always kind of gets the worst press of them all are the Pharisees. And it's not necessarily because they are the worst. I think you could make a case that the Sadducees are worse in some ways than the Pharisees. But the Pharisees are the ones that we know the best, and that's whose name we know. So we still use the word, people call somebody a Pharisee. If somebody ever calls you a Pharisee, you probably should take offense to it. It's not a compliment. All right, so a Pharisee, why would we call people that? What's wrong with these guys? Why are they bad? What's their problem? So that today, even if you called someone that, what do you mean by that? The fact is, it would be pretty hard in one line or one sentence to give a quick diagnosis of everything that's wrong with these guys. Read all the Gospels, all right? If you read all the Gospels, you get a full portrait of everything that's wrong with them and the things they needed to change. But for our purpose, what I want to do today is focus on one main thing. One main emphasis, one specific problem they have and kind of how that works itself out. So this text that we just read zeroes in on this main problem. This is the main emphasis. And it's more or less that the scribes and the Pharisees that he's talking to here were quite in love with what they perceived in themselves and what they projected to everybody else was their high moral and spiritual standing. They loved themselves, some themselves. They were really into their whole appearance. This is evidenced in what he says about them. His his assessment of them. And the summary of that whole passage we read, more or less, is that these guys, all their words that they said to the people and all their deeds and everything, it was all geared toward their appearance and their status. They served, among everything else, they served first and foremost their image that they had kind of crafted and that they loved to project. They loved the idea of who they were more than actually the substance, the idea of who they were. And in that sense, their reputation and their high moral status and their moral posturing became for them kind of like an idol. So we talked about it last week, the notion of idolatry. And, you know, it's so broad that it can mean anything and it can mean everything. And in point of fact, idolatry ends up being more about the idolater, more about the person doing it, than the thing itself. So remember, Paul even talks to the people and he says, you know, you've got this problem. You want stuff so bad. You're greedy. You want what other people have. You covet stuff. And remember what he said. He said, that is idolatry. He didn't bother to say what the stuff even was. He didn't even bother to list the actual things. I mean, we can guess what some things are. We know what people like. We know the biggies, right? We know people like money and possessions and power and pleasure and whatever else. We know what people mostly want, but this was really irrelevant. You can define idolatry almost by the attitude and disposition of the person more than the thing. He says, you covet what other people have? That's idolatry. Yeah, but you don't even know what it is. It doesn't matter. It's your attitude. There's something you want real bad, and you serve it. You like it too much. You worship it. You chase after it. You spend up all your money to get it. You're thinking about it all the time. So knowing that, then we can look at some of these peculiar things that we have to watch out for. We could be guilty of idolatries of a sort that don't look like the ones you typically think of. We could say, well, I'm not like a lot of people who go after those obvious things. But, you know, we always have to be on guard because, as we said, the human mind, the human heart is an ongoing, restless kind of master idol craftsman, right? The idol shop, always working. We can convert anything into an idol. So even the best things, even with these Pharisees, I mean, there are some good things about them in and of themselves. I mean, is devotion to the law a bad thing? No. I mean, the psalmist says, I love your law. I meditate on it day and night. That's not a bad thing. Knowing the scriptures, nothing bad about that. Keeping the rules, there's no harm there. Moral principles, good. Good for you. But even good things can become idolatrized. Is that a... Yeah, I like that. I would say idolized, but we use that in a different way, which means you look up to someone or something. But they can be converted into an idol. So what's the problem here, and what happens if this takes place? And, well, what we read there, those woes and those rebukes, give us a clue as to what everything that's entailed by somebody who makes an idol out of their own moral status, their own superiority, their own kind of high position and appearance, or whatever they think of themselves. What is the harm there? What can happen? So I'll show you some things, and I'll just enumerate them real easy, because I got four of them for you. Pride, we'll talk about pride, power, hypocrisy, and persecution. Now, and we'll sort of unpack all of them. Now, if I were any kind of real preacher, I'd make the hypocrisy a P word too, right? Got pride, power, and persecution. Then you got that renegade H in there. What's up? Where's the alliteration? Well, I like alliteration as much as the next guy, but the fact is, hypocrisy is just the right word. I couldn't think of a good enough P word to take its place. I wasn't going to sacrifice the perfection of hypocrisy as the right term here, the term that Jesus used twice when he's talking to them, for something else. So let's just look at each of these and think about what it is about these things. The person who takes their own moral positioning and posturing and sort of projects it out there, and it becomes the main thing, the thing they love most, the thing that they exalt most, the thing that they serve most, the image of how good and wonderful that they are. And what's wrong with that are some of these things. So let's look at some of these. So we talk about then pride. First one on the list, pride. You just love how people see you. The Pharisees were really into their image. So Jesus says to them, the scribes and the Pharisees, he's telling the people, scribes and Pharisees love their image. Right down to stuff they wear, they like to wear that exalted religious garb that sets them apart. And these things, you know, the phylacteries and the tassels that they got these things they wear, which a little biblical background is required to understand what he's talking about. But let's suffice it in the interest of time to simply say this, because I know we understand the concept, that sometimes people wear things that make them look like they're important, right? It's part of your, I mean, uniforms and vestments are part of how people get set apart to show their authority. You know, if you dress up in a cop uniform and you go out on the streets, you know you get in trouble for that. Yeah, they get impersonation to get you. Why? What's wrong? Why can't? I mean, no, maybe for Halloween you could skate by, but I wouldn't try to arrest anybody or brandish a weapon. However, the fact is, why is that? Because that uniform sort of designates their authority to that extent. Judges wear the robes, right? I mean, you have a lot of ministerial in different traditions. You know, they wear certain things. This is as old as people. That there are important kind of elements sometimes to this stuff. And what he's saying is these guys, not that there's necessarily anything wrong with those ideas, but they love it too much. They are really into being seen in their authoritative wear so that people see them and go, ooh, wow, you're not like us. Wow, you wear the cape. You know what I'm saying? You're not just like the rest of us. You're not just a faithful, believing Jew. You're a super Jew. Right? You're a hero among us with your flowing robe. You wear those phylacteries long as you can. Everybody to see them. This is pride. They're not wearing them just to demonstrate. I mean, it's got the wrong motive. We understand this. They like to sit in the important seats, he says, right? They like to sit in the places of honor. So everybody can look in those chairs and see them. Wow, look at you sitting in the big boy chair. You're at the big boy table. Wow, you're where the important people sit. This is where the cool kids sit. I mean, it takes many forms. But these guys like it. They love it. And so he's not complimenting them here. He's saying, look at them. Don't be like them, he says, right? You can observe a lot of what they teach. They teach some good things. But he's saying, but don't be like them. What does he mean by don't be like them? Well, he explains it. Don't love yourself too much. Let no one think more highly of himself than he ought to think, says Paul, right? These guys think way too much of themselves. And they just sit there, you know, in the important seats, the big seats, the seats of honor, and they're just hoping everybody will look and notice them. Feel like they're always on camera. Oh, the people are watching me. Make sure my best face is on. They like to be greeted. They want special greetings. They want to be recognized. They want people to stop shaking the hand and talking to whoever they're talking to and give them priority. Ooh, you've just been bumped by somebody more important. You know, it's like they're the kind of guys that would love the notion that people want their autograph if that had been a thing. You know? I want people to clamor about me. Ask for my autograph. Because what's more important than I wrote my name down for somebody? Never quite understood that anyway. Wow, I got a person to write their name on something. They want to be called rabbi. They like their titles. Anybody ever known somebody who got them a title and really loved their title and wanted everybody to call them by that title? Now, I've been teaching for years in different university settings, and I know for a fact over the years that there are those people in those settings. And by the way, the fact that I know this is a clue in and of itself. How do I know this about them? Because people talk. Because people go around saying, can you believe Professor So-and-so insists that everyone call them doctor. Now you may say, well, that's got... There are people like this. they sort of say on day one,
you will refer to me.
I mean, it's like they make sure and lay the ground rules that you will not address me like any normal, low-life, scumbag. I'm not one of you plebeians. No. You will call me by my special title. And almost it's almost like if you don't, I'm going to be mad. Hey, ministers can be just as bad.
You will refer to me as Reverend, the esteemed, the honorable.
And it's one thing if you have the title, good, that's nice. But to love the title, to need the title, to insist on the title, to demand the title. And this is not a good sign. But you know, this tendency is universal. Because it's funny, you know that even the worst tyrants in the world want to be thought of as good, by good titles, positive titles. This is an interesting fact. You know, we think of some of the worst characters in human history, the people that were sort of like the fascist, dictatorial, tyrannical people who murdered lots of people. And you might imagine that they ran around wearing that proudly, like one-dimensional villains in movies. You know, in movies you get villains and they love their villainy, right? They take pride in their villainy. It's almost like, I want to be called diabolical. I want everyone to address me as Dark Lord. But real evil people don't do that. They don't say, address me as, you know, your imminent darkness or whatever. They want to be called by good titles. You go to North Korea, where you've got a genuine, I mean, almost otherworldly dictator with absolute control. I mean, this a lot of blood on the man's hands. This is one cruel oppressor of people. But guess what? What he demands is that the people not call him your imminent cruelness. He wants to be called by positive good titles. He wants to hear the people call him wonderful, good, benevolent leader. Oh, the merciful. He's anything but those things. So you see, even the worst people want to hear that they're great. They want to hear their names associated with good titles and virtues. Even if they're completely, you know, completely cruel and barbaric torturers and murderers of mankind, they still want to hear. They want the good seats. They want the positivity. They want to be they want to be lauded with the praise of a saint. It's just something about us. We want that. Even, you know, how much worse for people who really are pretty good? I mean, who really do? I mean, the Pharisees weren't, you know, they weren't running around cutting people's throats and stealing everything. Maybe some of them are probably corrupt, but there were probably some Pharisees that were fairly decent people. I mean, they did keep the law. But then they had to go and love it too much that they did and turn that into their God. So pride is one trademark, key trademark. But what that conveys then is the second one, which is the power. There's a power play at work here, a kind of power politics, if you will, that they were engaged in over the people. They had standing. They had sway. Their voices mattered, and they knew it. The people had to listen to them, had to obey all their rules, and so they kept making more rules. Because if you can impose strict and rigid legalism on people, they got to run around being busy with everything you tell them to do. And that gives you tremendous power over them. Jesus said the scribes and the Pharisees do what? They impose these burdens, he said, right? They weigh everybody down with moral burdens. People can't fulfill all this stuff. Everyone's running around. The best people in the population who are really trying their hardest are just, you know, tiring themselves out to try to dance to the music of these guys and adhere to all of their little rules. But it's a game they can't win. It's the game of legalism, where there are 10,000 strict little sub-rules. So what the Pharisees did was expound and expand the Mosaic law and parse it out so finely that you almost couldn't wake up and get out of bed in the morning without having violated two or three commandments of some kind that they had invented. And it's already hard enough to be good and to do what's right, isn't it? Let alone swamping me with 10,000 extra regulations. Do I have a prayer fulfilling those? No, and that's part of the point. Because the unspoken idea here is that the Pharisees somehow can keep those obligations. And you're just not as good as they are. So you just fail miserably. People like to have power over other people, and there are a lot of ways to do it. But one of the most effective ways to do it is to lord it over people morally, so that they feel they're obligated to adjust the details of their behavior and their life to suit the regimen that you've kind of invented. And in this way, what you can do is you can kind of micromanage people. You can become a thought police, you know. You can't even think the wrong thing, or you're bad. You can't say the wrong word, or you're bad. You boss other people around. You can break the laws by just mistake or accident. And so, because guilt, is guilt powerful? If you can keep people under the thumb of guilt, then they're always servile to you. They're always trying to please you. The moral overlords with the high ground. And this is what the Pharisees were doing. Jesus says they're cruel to the people by imposing all these standards. Well, do they meet the standards? Of course they don't. Which is the third thing on my list here. Hypocrisy. Their performance was way down below. Way down below their actual posturing. The things they said, right? All the things they were imposing, they couldn't live up to them. They didn't live up to them. They preach, he said, but they do not practice. Now, let's be honest here. Is anybody here able to consistently always live up to all your own standards? Don't be a liar. Nobody can do that. So now, how do we deal with that? If by definition, a hypocrite is somebody who has moral standards, things that you think are right, and you haven't consistently made an A plus in all those areas. Well, then, aren't you a hypocrite? Well, if that is so, then by definition, well, we're all hypocrites. Just by definition. In that sense, we would all be hypocrites. And there's no way not to be one. It would be impossible not to be one. Well, hey, you might say, what if I just have no standards? Hey, no standards. Well, okay, that might be one way. You might think you might get out of hypocrisy there. Of course, if you could do that, you would have only run from the lion to meet the bear. I mean, in other words, you would have swapped out one problem for a thousand times worse problem, right? To have no moral standards would be to try to cure your cold with cancer. You'd be way worse off like that. But I would argue that you can't even really do that, because I'm not sure the person exists who can actually erase all their moral standards and have none. Because even those people that you might identify, you might look around and you might identify some people and say, "Man, that person has very low moral standards." But that doesn't mean they have none. So even that person, the person that you might see and say, the person has very low moral standards, so that person probably is never guilty of hypocrisy. Not so fast. That person has some moral standards. And inevitably, they fail to live up to even those. I mean, this happens a lot, by the way. I talked about this phenomenon before that I see all around, really. I see this all the time, just out in the world, you know. There will be people that I meet, and you know that a lot of people like this. And, you know, maybe they're not really churchgoers, or they sometimes are, but their lives are just, they've made a lot of bad decisions, right? So their lives are really in bad shape. They've brought a lot of evil on themselves. They don't really see things the right way. There's a lot of confusion and self-destructive stuff and all that. And yet, you hear them talk, and they're always, when they're in their talking, there's a lot of moralizing going on. You know, you overhear them, and you would think to hear them talk that they have the highest moral standards of the world. Well, I would never, and I told her that I am just not going to be. You know, people, you know what I'm saying? They talk like that. They sound like they just have the highest moral standards. Their life doesn't sort of look like that too much, because everyone wants to. So in that sense, everyone's a hypocrite because nobody lives up. So what am I talking about? Is Jesus just talking about all of us the same? He is not. We know the difference. We know the difference. What he's referring to here, these people who have made idols, have manufactured idols out of their sense of goodness, their hypocrisy is brazen. It's just open. It's with no regard. Why? The fact is, they don't really even care about. They don't care about their actual performance. That's not their concern. That's not what they're into. That's not what they serve. So it's not just that they try, but nobody can live up to their. No, that's not their case. He's talking about the scribes and the Pharisees, as at least some of them, who don't even try that hard to really be as good as they pretend they are. Because all of their effort and energy is in the upkeep and maintenance of their image. So their actual performance, the actual scoreboard, that's second. That's down the list. Like, that's not what. That doesn't really matter that much to them. What matters is how they appear, how they look, not the truth of the matter. And so, you know, the image, the authority that they have over people, this advantage that it gives them, those great seats they get, called by those great titles, the influence they have over people, the fact that people are under their thumb, that's what they're into. Not the actual real holiness that they are supposed to practice as these exalted holy men who know the law. They don't care about that. And that's the difference. And I just have to ask you, think about it now. Is there anything more off-putting than that? I mean, is there anything that makes people just walk away with a bad taste in their mouth? More than that. What do you think people say, non-church-going people, when they're asked about their take on people, on church-going, on Christians, and they think about that and they give their assessment, especially people who are critical, what do you think's always in the top three? Every single time. Sometimes maybe it's a number one, I guess. It's this. Well, hypocrites. I just can't deal with hypocrites. And you know, all it really took in most people's history and background is one person that they looked up to. One person who was Pharisee-like. Too good to be true. I mean, just like, I could never aspire to be like them. So good. So perfect, so wonderful. And then they came to find out that they weren't really like that. And the old stained glass image just shatters. And some of those people just will have nothing to do with it ever, ever again. Very off-putting. It really is a poison in the minds of the world that the church is trying to reach out to see just open and brazen hypocrisy like that. There was a widely known writer and philosopher, British philosopher named Bertrand Russell. Pretty famous, pretty well known. Decidedly non-Christian. Decidedly so. Sort of considered himself agnostic or whatever. But it's interesting something his daughter said years after in all of her interaction with him. His daughter was a believer. And his daughter said this about him. She said, I would have liked to convince my father that I had in fact found what he had been looking for, what he had longed for really all of his life and all of his studies and readings and all of his attempts. She says, I would like to have done that. But, she said, it felt hopeless because he had known too many Christians who were bleak moralists, who sucked the joy right out of everyone's life and persecuted their opponents, and he just would never have been able to see the truth they were hiding. That's how she put it. Probably there are countless people who one of their biggest obstacles is that they've witnessed too much Phariseeism. The hypocrisy goes along with the picture. So the pride of people that swells, and then the power they get over people. But they don't meet their own standards, so they're just hypocrites. And what this typically does is it turns them into persecutors. Jesus said, I send prophets, wise men, scribes, he said. And what response do they get from these religious leaders? Are they welcomed? Do the leaders say, wow, you're wise, you have something to teach us. Wow, help us understand where we may have blind spots. Help us become better. Show us where we might be failing. No, of course not. Their immediate response, their almost knee-jerk reaction to those people is to feel threatened by anyone who speaks actual truth. They feel threatened. So they persecute, they punish, and they even kill people. Ironic, of course, that Jesus himself is saying these words, right? Not too long before this will prophetically end up being his destiny at their hands. They're going to call for his head because he is saying these kinds of things, pointing these things out about them. So they don't like it because it threatens their power. So there's a creeping kind of fascism. There's this sort of pharisaical control. They want it, and they won't. They don't look to get the control over people by winning over hearts and minds. It's not through gentle persuasion. It becomes a strong arm tactic. You will call me great. You will recognize my greatness because you darn well better. That's the irony of the sort of the great leader syndrome, right? That's the bizarro world element of the North Korea syndrome, where everyone hails the wonderful virtues of the great leader because he will murder us if we do not. And surely the irony can't escape us, right? That's not how you get that kind of praise. Oh, you're so wonderful. Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. Oh, you're just the most loving person. Don't torture me. Don't torture me. Don't torture me. Please notice me saying good things about you. That's not how that works. Augustine, Saint Augustine, if you like, talked about this. He talked about the soul that is inordinately enamored of its own power so that it despises the more the just dominion of a higher authority. Because even God becomes a threat to you. Even God is now your rival. So truth is a threat. Truth is a hated enemy. And by the way, this is one of the surest signs that there's a problem, that this particular problem is at play. One of the surest signs that when you will not listen to someone speak any truth to you, when you just won't hear it, when you're not open to say, all right, a wise person, I'm teachable. A person who shuts the door to that and says, I have nothing to learn. And anyone who threatens me and questions me, I will just come against them. That's pretty much a giant red flag that you're dealing with this kind of a problem. So they become persecutors. And this is sort of summarized. Here's a good summary by somebody who wrote an article about this phenomenon in the world today. I thought it was pretty good. This is a professor in British Columbia. Here's an excerpt of kind of how he put this. He says, morality then is corrupted when it masks cruel and vain motivations, when it's used as a weapon to beat other people down or to secure a position of power and influence, to control other people, to acquire social and material benefits. In these cases, morality becomes hypocritical and fraudulent. You will see this pattern in a lot of places. You know, in talking on Wednesday night about some of these big shot prosperity preachers, and this is a shameless plug, we will continue talking about those guys for a couple of weeks here. One of the things you see this pattern in them, right? Their greatness, they're serving their own interests, their wealth, their esteem. They love people to come to them. Please, I need you. Please show me the secret. Please give me your power. Please. It makes them feel so great. And they're big shots, and they fly on the private jet to the next place where the people hail them. And they're honored in their own TV. And they care about how they look, which is why they start looking even weirder and weirder, because they overdo it, right? How many of them have you ever seen open to questioning? No. They do not accept questions. They do not accept criticism. Anyone who dares come against what they're teaching and criticize what they're teaching or critique it from a biblical foundation, why, they will simply rain down their judgment on them. You may not touch the Lord's anointed. And try to just pull their own authority against people who would question them. Remember when we talked about the Reformation? Remember we spent some time doing the background and the background and the context of the Reformation? The pattern in those times fits all of these things. The real authorities during the Reformation, the church authorities at the time were powerful. They were big shots. They were the educated. They were of high birth. They had all the money in their power. They were clothed with authority, right? They wore the robes. And when they went from town to town, the uneducated masses looked up to them. You've got the truth. You teach us the truth. And they liked that. It gave them power over the people, did it not? Luther looked out and he said, these people are just like dogs that are trying to pick up crumbs from these guys. There's such a gulf between these exalted clergy and these lowly lay people. That's not how that should be. They had the power to unlock heaven's treasures, to forgive people's sins. So they lorded it over the people in order to get the people to serve them, do what they want, and of course give them their money. It fits the bill. Did those people live up to it? No. They didn't live up to their own vows that they had taken as holy men. There was rampant immorality in high places. Remember all of those reformers before Luther even who came along. One of the main complaints they all had. Remember those guys, Wycliffe, and then the Lollards, and those guys in France. And who was the Dominican guy whose name I forget that they burned in the Italian town square? Savonarola. You know what all of them would say over and over is one of their main things was that the clergy they're not living right. I mean, in other words, there was a moral problem at the time. The clergy are living like a bunch of fat cats. So they weren't living up to it. And then, of course, quite obviously, did they become persecutors? Yeah. Ask Savonarola. Oh, I'm sorry, you can't. They turned him into ashes. Just like they did Jan Hus, right? And just like they did Wycliffe, though, he died first, and then they went ahead and just dug up his body and went ahead and burned him anyway. So, yeah, persecution. You see the pattern fulfilled. Incidentally, lest you think this only can happen among the religious, this is human nature, and you can see this pattern play out even outside of overtly religious context. Even in a secular context, this tends to happen. There was a writer recently in the Vancouver Sun. He wrote about this, and it's interesting. He said they're finding. He said that observers are. He said observers. This is a quote. Have become increasingly concerned about how oppressive, holier than thou attitudes have been taking over secular spaces. It's like we got the old traditional religious people out of the secular space, and what do you know? A bunch of new Pharisees moved in. With their own holier-than-thou oppressive attitudes. And what are they talking about? Well, just consider. I mean, look around. Have you noticed the sort of self-righteousness of a lot of secular moralism? This kind of narcissism in our age, it leads to this habit of what they sometimes call virtue signaling. If you go online, just scroll along and look at everybody. Going out of their way to one-up the last person, to basically hold up big banners on the social media that says, look how good I am. Look what I stand for. Look what cause I fight for. Am I not good? Am I not wonderful? Am I not a saint? Shouldn't you be more like me? Why, I stand for causes. And it's like a display, and I got to one-up the next one. And if one person took a stand for a cause, I got to take a stronger stand for that cause. And if one person expressed a kind of outrage about something moral, I got to outdo their outrage. I got to be more outraged than thou, to show that I'm good. You see this everywhere. I've got to show that I'm a warrior for the good. And because I am, this leads to the next thing. Because I am, I feel good about myself. I am good. And I'm showing it. And people should see that I'm good. And this basically can give me a sense of entitlement. I can make demands on people. You must recognize me, my goodness. You must recognize my goodness. You must yield to the things I say. You must talk the way I say you should talk. You can't use the words I say that I think you shouldn't use. You can't even think the thoughts I think are not good thoughts. Or I'll stick the thought police on you. I'll get you fired. Don't worry. I'll ruin your reputation. You had better conform. There's a certain power that I have. In fact, because I'm virtuous and good, I can actually use some tactics that other people can't use because those would be wrong. I can use some I can use some tactics that otherwise some people would say are immoral, but because I'm good, I can give myself license to do those things. So I can be louder, nastier, uglier, and I can go, in fact, I can go on tirades and use a bunch of vile language and really say nasty things about you. Ordinarily, that would be bad, but because I'm so good and stand for the good causes, I give myself permission. And, of course, I will come down hard and persecute those. Are people like that typically receptive to someone who might say, you know, may I make an observation? Are you open to some critique of your position? No. No. The common theme of people today is to not listen to what anybody says. Like the Pharisees of old, if I smell you coming, if I smell you coming from a mile off that you might not agree with me, I will immediately turn the heat up on you. I'm certainly not going to listen. My instinct is to crucify my critic, not to listen to my critic. I will only crucify my critic. This is the woe. This is the warning. There is only one God who demands your worship and is jealous for it. No idols whatsoever. You shall have no other gods, including your own sense of your wonderful goodness and virtue. May we all be virtuous. May we all be holy people. This is the sanctification process for which we strive. But don't stick it up on the altar. Don't enthrone it and begin to burn the incense to your own image. These other things will follow.